And now, it's time for the talk of the Northwest. The 9 to Noon Show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning, and you're very welcome along to the 9 till noon show here on Highland Radio with me, Greg Hughes, for this Wednesday, the 30th of July, 2025. How are you all keeping? How's your week going so far? Well, hopefully it's going well as your day. We are open for business on the phone lines, by the way, so we've got lots lined up to hopefully keep you informed and entertained over the next 3 hours, but we want to hear from you as well. Either comments on what we're talking about or to raise your own issues. 086 60 25,000, that's your WhatsApp and text number, 086 60 25,000. If you're outside the Republic, it's 00353 86 60 25,000. And if you want to give us a call, Caroline and Shannon taking your calls on 07491 25,000, and emails come into us from anywhere, comments@highlandradio.com. Let's have a look at some of the front pages of the papers today. We'll start with the local, the Finn Valley Voice, and their coverage is of Donegal's homecoming on Monday night. They stood drenched and in despair, yet with a flicker of hope to the future. Thousands packed into the Pier car park in Donegal Town on Monday night to welcome home the Donegal senior football team. 24 hours after losing to Kerry in Sunday's All-Ireland final at Croke Park, the banks of Donegal Bay were thronged as well-wishers came out to show their appreciation. "There's a lot of hurt behind me. There's a lot of pain behind me," manager Jim McGuinness acknowledged. "There's no doubt about it. These fellas wanted to stand in front of you and have Sam Maguire. I really hope this can be a moment they can latch on to that will make them stronger and more resilient and bring them to a point where they are in a better position than they were yesterday afternoon." And no doubt he's right, especially if he sticks around and leads them. There's no doubt there are better days to come, and it's just one more game that would be required to be the All-Ireland champions. Just to follow up on the coverage we carried yesterday of the investigation into the death and the trial following the death of Private Sean Rooney. Irish officials believe Lebanese authorities are aware of the whereabouts of a Hezbollah member who was on Monday convicted of the murder of Private Sean Rooney 3 years ago. Mohammed Ayad was sentenced to death in absentia by a Lebanese military court for killing the Defence Forces member in December 2022. The sentence is likely to be later commuted to a prison term. Now, in absentia means effectively he wasn't in court, so he was convicted in his absence. Ayad was accused of firing his weapon into Private Rooney's 4x4 vehicle during an attack in the village of Al-Aqibya. Six other accused received lesser sentences, while one was acquitted. But obviously what's going to pain here even further is that Lebanese authorities may be aware of where this person is, and yet he's still not before the courts to hear his sentence and to serve his sentence, albeit a death sentence likely to be commuted to something else. Interesting, just to get a figure on the dodgy box industry. One person apparently was making $450,000 a year from illegal streaming services. This is in the Irish Independent and most of the papers, in fact. A man must pay €480,000 in damages to Sky after conceding a high court action taken by the broadcaster over his operation of a dodgy box streaming service. David Dunbar consented to judgment against him after opting not to defend the civil case brought by Sky UK Limited over his infringement of copyright. He faces further sanction for being in contempt of court, having breached orders aimed at preserving evidence of his copyright infringement orders, freezing his assets, among other directions. A number of sanctions are open to the court, including imprisonment. Dunbar, who has an address at Manor Crescent in County Wexford, was previously described by Sky as a top-level copyright infringer who may have earned up to €450,000 a year from operating an illegal streaming service. The broadcaster alleged that he had provided thousands with access to copyright broadcast material since 2018. And it just goes to show the amount of money that's in it. That's one individual, $450K. And obviously he's charging much less than Sky and BT and everyone else. But you can see why the likes of Sky are cracking down on these providers, can't you? Right, the next story is a very difficult story to read out, because obviously, particularly being it it being the summer, they're all younger ears, so I'll try and be as sensitive as I can. This will only take about 30 seconds, but this is in the Irish Sun and all papers, of course. A former guard who impersonated a female colleague online and incited men to come to her home and assault her has been caged. Shane Flanagan, 39, was sentenced to 8 years in prison with the final year suspended. Flanagan, with an address in County Clare, impersonated the woman in a fetish website and on Facebook and engaged in graphic online discussions with users of these sites about violence of a sexual nature and other things which I just won't mention at the moment. He also shared the woman's personal information, including her address, photos of her and her daughter. And it only really came to light when a person, however, I don't know what these people be doing in these online spaces, but apparently they arranged to do this consensual, non-consensual activity, which to me seems completely bizarre. But anyway, that the person who was going to visit the female officer contacted her on a different Facebook page and was alerted to the fact that she wasn't engaging with him at all at all. But what could motivate someone in the first instance to engage in this activity, but also in this Garda's case, Shane Flanagan, to actually find himself in these websites and doing this to another individual? Mr. Justice Creedon set a headline sentence of 10 years and reduced it to 8 to take into account factors including the pleas of guilty, his written apology to the victims, and the fact that prison would be more difficult for him as a former Garda. But you could counter that and say, as a former Garda, he should know much, much better. Staying with the force, and a Garda was stabbed in broad daylight in the capital yesterday. I'm sure you've heard, this is in the Irish Daily Star. The horrific incident took place at around 6 p.m. on Capel Street on Dublin city centre's north side. It's understood a man ran towards two Garda officers shouting and then attacked them. One officer, a probationary Garda, was taken to hospital where his injuries are non-life threatening. It's understood he was stabbed twice and he's since been released, obviously, since this paper went to press. The violent incident is currently being treated as a random and unprovoked attack, and there is no suspicion at this stage that it is terror-related. A heavy Garda presence was being maintained last night with an area of Capel Street near the intersection with Little Britain Street taped off. A Garda spokesperson said the injured officer was subjected to an unprovoked assault while on high visibility control. In other words, when they say unprovoked, they weren't engaging with him in the course of their duty. This person just approached them, and apparently the stab vest the Garda had on suffered damage, so it did its job to some extent. I believe he got a laceration on his upper arm, unfortunately, it seems to be part of the job now. There's a serious assault on Garda almost every day, if not every day. Do you flash people to warn them of speed checks or speed vans? How many out of 10 would you say do? Would you say 10 out of 10, 7 out of 10, 5 out of 10? Well, it's about 3 out of 10. Some 28% of Irish motorists flash their headlights to warn oncoming drivers about a speed van, and 4% text or call friends or family to alert them. Nearly 1 in 5 drivers, 17%, report feeling more stressed after passing a speed van. A poll of 858 drivers by insurance company Aviva also found almost a third of drivers do not believe speed cameras are a deterrent to speeding, especially in accident-prone areas. And 46% of drivers, almost half, consider average speed cameras to be somewhat effective, while 22% say they are very effective in encouraging safer driving. And, this is their own private lives, but there seems to be a great deal of interest because it's covered on the front page of all the papers. And this is the news that Late Late Show host Patrick Keelty and Kat Deely, they've insisted there's no one else involved as the couple announced their shock split after 13 years together. The TV stars, who wed in September 2012 at a ceremony in Rome, announced they had separated in a joint statement yesterday. But the pair, who have two sons together, Milo 9 and 7-year-old James, insist there is no other parties involved. And they said in a joint statement, "We've taken the decision to end our marriage and are now separated. There's no other party involved. We will continue to be united as loving parents to our children and would therefore kindly ask for our family privacy to be respected." And hopefully it is respected. I'm sure it's incredibly tough for them. And they do seem like two genuinely nice people individually and I suppose collectively as well. So wish them nothing but good wishes into the future. Right, so our text line 086 60 25,000, 086 60 25,000, or give us a call on 07491 25,000. I've the last couple of days a nausea. I don't know what's causing it, but just can't eat properly. And then when you can't eat, your brain doesn't seem to function correctly. But anyway, we're getting there. Had breakfast this morning and things are improving. A caller says, we wonder why our country's falling apart and in financial crisis, but we've just paid Justin Kelly, the new Garda commissioner, a salary of $314,000 a year for 5 years. Is anyone worth a salary of this scale? Well, the difficulty is that you're competing with the private sector as well. So you are going to have to, I mean, it's a ridiculous amount of money. I don't condone it or agree with it. And at the same time, I don't criticise it because I really don't know. But it's one of the highest profile jobs in the country and you need to be really, really on top of your game. And we've seen from Mr. Kelly's predecessor that it's a very easy job to get wrong. So we'll see. I think time will tell if he's worth the €314,000. Having a laugh at us again, OPW trying to clear up a mess with our money, a housing and development build where it should never have been. This is in relation to the properties in Burnfoot. A housing and development build where it should never have been built, even managed to put a housing development treatment plant at the intersection of a river and tributary. Look at the maps from 100 years ago. They wouldn't build it there. Yeah, Greg, thanks for getting us a surgical hub. Well, the person's tongue in cheek. I don't think we can take the credit for that. But anyway, I think we helped. But I'll read on. Yeah, Greg, thanks for getting us the surgical hub. Now, how's about a minor injuries clinic to take pressure off Letterkenny ED? I don't know. Yes, indeed. And we've got people's stories of their experiences with Letterkenny University Hospital and so much more besides coming up in the next wee while. But we'll take a break. Rejoin us in a couple of moments. And we say good morning now to Susan. Hi, Susan. Good morning.
Good morning, Greg, and happy Wednesday to you and your
listeners. Happy Wednesday, indeed. Right, okay. So you sent us an email, and rather than me sort of try and pick through it, maybe it's best if I just hand it over to you, Susan, and tell us the story in your own words.
Yes, unfortunately, we had reason to visit Letterkenny Hospital last week. Our 15-year-old grandson, Toby, and his 17-year-old pal, Fred, was staying with us from the UK. And unfortunately, his pal had an accident resulting in a head injury.
Mm.
You know, we got the car and my grandson was great. You know, he shouted to his grandpa and we got the car and, you know, I came out, I'd been gardening and looked at Fred, looked at the cut and got a tea towel, you know, got some things that were non-bloody and we got in the car. I thought it was, you know, a nasty gash on his head. We went to the hospital in the car. It took us about 20 minutes, but that journey, just within maybe about 10 minutes, Fred's behaviour changed so quickly. You know, we couldn't, he wouldn't keep the tea towel, the wet tea towel on his head. My grandson was having to hold it there, sort of fight him to keep it there. He was losing consciousness, hanging out the window. And it was pretty scary. So anyway, cut a long story short, we got to the hospital accident emergency 20 minutes later, and when we were getting out the car, Fred could hardly stand. We went into reception, you know, and the receptionist was fabulous. I mean, I didn't even know Fred's address because this was a pal who was staying from the UK. Mm. I didn't know his doctor, didn't know his medications. Anyway, the receptionist within, and I mean this literally, Greg, was in less than 2 minutes. He was in a wheelchair and within 4 minutes, he was on a stretcher been treated by at least six or seven professionals in accident and emergency. It was the care we received. So I suppose, Greg, there's two things I want to highlight today. Firstly, and the main reason for my call is to highlight the exceptional care we received from Letterkenny Accident and Emergency staff and the ICU team as well. It was exceptional. I don't think I've ever experienced care like that. It was so professional, but calm, controlled, understanding, you know, caring. Not one person that dealt with us that day made us feel that they were just doing their job. They really cared. The number of updates we got, it was just fantastic. It was like service I've never experienced, and I'm old now. But most probably I'm going off at a tangent, really, because it, Fred had a concussion, and they thought his injury was worse than it was. They thought perhaps it was a brain trauma, a swelling, a bleed. So he was put on a ventilator and into a coma. And it was a horrendous afternoon and evening, to be honest. And we thought, we really expected, the medics thought that he was going to have to be taken to Dublin. But miraculously, the CT scan showed no brain injury. They spent several days in ICU before he was released. But as I say, you know, we've lived here for a long time now, and, you know, every week, you know, you hear negative stories about Letterkenny Hospital. However, you know, what we experienced last week was second to none.
Oh, yeah, but, I mean, what a stressful experience. I mean, initially thinking, right, it's a cut to the head, him deteriorating in the car, I can only imagine how that might feel. And, yes, it's great to see a quick response and many medical professionals around the stretcher, but at the same time, too, you know, it makes you think, wow, this is really very, very serious then, or it may well, or it possibly could. And then for him to be placed on a ventilator, I mean, what a... To get to the good news, my word, it was a lot of, what must have felt like extremely bad news and a very stressful situation for everyone involved, not least maybe his family removed from the situation in Britain.
Exactly, exactly. And of course, you know, I'm saying to Toby, my grandson, well, wait till we get to the hospital. I thought we were just going for stitches, you know, for a, you know, maybe a, you know, 1.5, 2-inch cut. But it was very, very stressful. As I say, it just got out of hand so quickly. And Greg, I had no experience of concussion, but that was the other point that I wanted to make today, was the importance of watching for concussion and dealing with it so quickly. As I said, this was a, you know, a strapping young man, 17, you know, fit, healthy, you know, reduced to, you know, unable to control his behaviour. He was all over the place. You know, he was completely out of it. Couldn't answer questions my grandson was asking. And it never happened right away. I think maybe that's what I wanted to, you know, to convey to your readers. You know, this happened maybe 10 minutes later, I would say. Mm-hmm. You know, it started to go awry. It was a shocking experience, but as I say, not just Fred was so well cared for, but we were too. The paramedics, you know, they were coming in and bringing us a wee cup of tea, and I was, of course, very distressed, and not knowing when. Of course, we had to phone. You mentioned phoning the family back in the UK. Of course, we had to do that because he was going on a ventilator, and he was so bad. So trying to get them, and of course, his father had to come over from the UK. He flew to Dublin and drove up in a hired car that night. My daughter flew over as well, you know, to support us all. So it was a horrendous experience, most probably one of the worst of my life, I've got to say.
I'd imagine so. It took a wee while to get over that, you know, because even though it eventually ended up being much less worse than it could have been, you still have gone through all the trauma of it possibly being as bad as it could be. And you can't just switch that off. That sticks with you for a while. So you'll have to work through that. But at least, you know, Fred, he's in good form. He's going through a concussion protocol now, which is... do you know what that is, out of interest?
So I think it's, you know, all part of... You know, he's not allowed to play. He's a rugby man.
Okay.
Plays cricket. So, you know, he's very active, so he can't play contact sports for several weeks. No alcohol, no stress, no loud noises, you know, and if there is any kind of headaches as well, any kind of sign that the concussion may be coming back, then he needs to go immediately to his local hospital.
But so, as 17-year-olds I'm told also he's already probably well over it emotionally, looking forward to getting back to Donegal.
Yes, yes. You know, he was so upset his holiday had been curtailed. He, you know, he loves it here, loves the people here. Oh, and that's another point I should say, sorry, Greg, it's never been on the radio before, so, and I'm renowned for being all over the place. But I wanted to also thank, in addition to, you know, Aoife reception, you know, the reception, I think it was Marion, Megan, Peter, Annette, Holly, just to name but a few, but the patients were lovely too. Not the patients, the patients' relatives.
Yeah.
They were so kind to us that day. Even, you know, Toby got a big hug from somebody who was sitting waiting outside in the accident and emergency, you know, because he was so upset at his pal and being so ill, you know, that he even got a hug. So don't go, people supporting everyone always. It was just great.
Okay.
So out of a terrible situation, hopefully there will come some good by getting the message across and boosting morale at the hospital for the staff and maybe the people of Donegal. You know, I'd most probably not given a very great description of concussion.
No, it's been very clear, Susan, and we appreciate you sharing the story with us. And it's important to highlight too when the system works very well. And you know, often when we talk about delays and issues at LUH, it's maybe sometimes, you know, everyone's triaged and the most serious of people are looked after very, very, very quickly. But sometimes, you know, maybe someone's in there with a twisted ankle or something, and it might be very important to them, but they're well down the list, and often it can be they that can experience the long delays. But in a life and death emergency situation, they are the best, and obviously they took every precaution, took every action to try and ensure Fred
definitely
was in the
Greg,
best of
hands. And
Greg,
I just want to say, I'm not making light of any other people's experiences.
No, of course not. My word, that doesn't come across like that at all. No. Your story is very, very important and good to get out. And I appreciate, Susan, you helping us get it out there, and pass on our best wishes to all involved.
Thank you very much,
okay.
Greg.
Bye-bye. Thanks. Take care of yourself, Susan. Thanks very much. Now, Emma Kavanagh is Head of Clinical Services at the Rutland Centre and joins us on the programme now. Emma, thanks for your time today.
Morning, Greg. Thank you so much for inviting me on.
I'm just really interested in your take on what we are seeing, what trends we're seeing, rather than necessarily what the headlines are saying or reporters taking it. I'm not questioning the coverage of it, but I'd be really just interested in you know, what you would read from the trends we're seeing.
Yeah, sure. A couple of things. I think the things that really stand out for me in our annual report are firstly the huge increase in cocaine across all demographics, across all genders, across all ages. Like, that's really, really stark. In 2023, about 17% of our residential inpatient clients were presenting with cocaine as a primary addiction, and that rose then to 23% in 2024. So that's really significant. And I suppose that's not happening in isolation. Like, the Health Research Board has released a number of different stats, all of great concern around cocaine use over the last number of weeks and months. So cocaine certainly is a real problem. And when I reflect on my own practice, like when I'm in group therapy with people, when I'm in individual therapy with people and they're talking to me about their cocaine use, you know, they're saying things that are pretty concerning and pretty alarming. Like I'm hearing a couple of things, I think, which are all coming together in a layered way then, and maybe in part explain this increase. So I'm hearing from a lot of people that when they first started using cocaine, they did so with the kind of misconception that it wasn't that addictive. And I know that can seem like a bit outrageous that people might think that, but that is the misconception out there, that cocaine really isn't that serious, it isn't that addictive. And that's simply not the case. Mm. It doesn't have the same physiological withdrawal that other drugs might have. And that's where maybe the misconception comes from, but it is very, very addictive. The other big thing I'm hearing from clients in relation to cocaine is how easily accessible it is for them. And I think, you know, modern technology, while it's our friend in lots of ways, in this instance, you know, is really not helping the situation. So people are able to use lots of apps, lots of very legitimate apps, social media apps, to log into. And there's kind of pages, you know, masquerading as legitimate businesses or legitimate individuals. And actually, it's just a way of scoring cocaine online. And then there's specific apps developed on the dark web as well, too, where people can avail of promotions and offers on drugs and on cocaine. And then you have things like drone deliveries then, which are really breaking down barriers that used to exist that would be a deterrent to people's usage, you know, like location, that's no longer an issue. So it's things like that all coming together and leading us probably to these higher figures, I think.
Yeah, and there must be a sense then that it's, you know, the lesser of two evils compared to alcohol, for an example. You know, I mean, obviously... Yeah. The cost of alcohol is increasing all the while. I don't know what, I haven't a clue what price cocaine is, but is that a factor as well when people are thinking of socialising?
Definitely. And I think if you look at the demographics around cocaine, while it does definitely cross all different demographics, like there is a higher concentration in men and women in their 20s, 30s and 40s. And these are probably the people who are out maybe socialising a little bit more. And that is one of the things, exactly as you're saying there, Greg, that I hear, that it's much more cost effective for people, they tell me, to use cocaine on a night out than it is to go and spend a night in a pub or in a bar, that will cost them a lot more. And one of the other big things I'm hearing, and I suppose the context of this is like the people in their 20s and in their 30s are the generation who've grown up on social media, where their appearance is scrutinized to the minute kind of detail, and they're much more body conscious and image conscious maybe than generations gone past. And there's a misguided kind of thinking in that generation that cocaine has no calories. So I can go out and I can use a bag of cocaine on a night out and I'm not going to be ingesting additional calories. That's going to derail my weight loss journey. I'm not going to be hungover tomorrow, so I can still get to the gym. Like, we live in a very gym obsessed culture as well. It's not going to impact my workout and my gains tomorrow. And these are all the things that we hear clients talk about, which I think is playing out.
Yeah, but there's no real counter narrative there, is there? Unless I'm not hearing it.
Yeah, well, I suppose maybe there's not enough kind of awareness around the harms of cocaine. And that's one of the things that we are really wanting to highlight when we come out with our report this year, that cocaine is really problematic. It's really serious. I think there's kind of this strange hierarchy of drugs and the drug-taking world, and it's spilling out into the mainstream, where we see some drugs as being really, really bad and some as being not so bad. And invariably, cocaine is seen as being not so bad. Things like heroin are seen as being really, really bad. But cocaine and heroin are both class A drugs. Yeah. They're both illegal.
So does that mean like someone might say, I don't really do drugs, I only do cocaine? Is it sort of that's where cocaine is being sort of positioned in that whole space, especially with the advent of, you know, an awful lot of the drugs we're seeing in America, but also now making the way into this country in Britain?
Yeah, I think people probably justify their cocaine use by comparing them with other kind of drugs. But the effects of cocaine are very real, very devastating, very serious. Like, people will experience all the same, eventually, devastating consequences in their lives by using and becoming addicted to cocaine as they will by using and becoming addicted to heroin or alcohol. And we see that in our centre every day. I think what people don't realise with cocaine as well is the huge psychological and psychiatric impact it can have. Like, we have seen, if you look at some of the health research boards stats on that, we have seen a huge increase in the number of psychiatric hospital admissions related to cocaine over the last 20 years. Like, they used to be, back about 20 years ago, 0.2% of 100,000, you know, was kind of the figure in the general population. That's risen to 2.4. Wow. That's like 100% increase on psychiatric hospitalizations associated with cocaine use. Deaths, you know, people who die by suicide related to cocaine, you know, has risen by nearly 2,000% in the last 20 years as well. So there are very real and very devastating consequences to cocaine. And perhaps, yeah, that isn't spoken about enough. It's seen very benignly and it's nearly glamorized, I think.
Yeah, and I'm not conflating issues, but we have this massive cynicism almost to, you know, tested, licensed medicine, and yet this absolute trust for criminals providing us with this product that we have no idea what is in it. No idea what's in it.
Yeah, and that's the thing. We don't know what it's cut with. We don't know what it's laced with. You might get a batch on a Monday. The one that you get then the next Tuesday, the next Wednesday can be entirely different. And you don't know how that's going to affect the body. And you don't know how that is going to affect other things that you might be ingesting too, and what the interplay is going to be between them. So really, people are taking huge, huge risks when they're ingesting cocaine.
When someone presents with cocaine as the primary addiction, Emma, how far down the line are they? Is it like they've been taking it for a month or two and they realise, well, I need to take it all the while? Or is it like other addictions where there's a rock bottom? Is, you know, is, are the trends similar with cocaine addiction to other addictions?
Yeah, they tend to be similar and very varied. There's huge variance. Some people will, I suppose, become awake to the issue much sooner in the trajectory. Other people will end up bringing about much more devastation to themselves, to their lives, to their loved ones before they get to that point. But I suppose what we're, how we define addiction in Rutland, and this would be kind of supported and backed by the World Health Organization, like, we wouldn't get overly caught up in, you need to be using X amount of cocaine to have a cocaine addiction. You need to be using cocaine this frequently to have a cocaine addiction. Like, what we're saying is, let's look at your relationship with cocaine. How is your relationship with cocaine, your taking of cocaine, affecting you across a couple of core aspects of your life, of your functioning? How is it affecting your relationships? How is it affecting you psychologically? How is it affecting you physically? How is it affecting your employment, your leisure pursuits, your finances? And when we start to see that it's affecting things in your life, those core things in your life, in a negative way, that's how we know that there's an addiction at play. Because if we think about it, if we're doing anything and it affects us negatively, we tend to stop. So if we're doing something and it's affecting us negatively, but yet we're pursuing with it, that's when we know that it's crossed some threshold into some sort of addictive process. Yeah. And it's the same with cocaine.
And we're watching it grow in usage all the time. You know, 4 or 5 years ago, people were saying it's as easy to get cocaine in Donegal as it is to get a pizza. We're not going any, we don't seem to be doing anything to sort of push back on that. It's just what we're seeing now is stats from the likes of, and the real people, you know, accessing the services of the Rutland Centre. We're starting to see the consequences of that now.
Yeah. And you're right. That's exactly what I hear from people. It's as easy, if not easier, to order cocaine than it is to order pizza. And I suppose that's a very difficult thing to tackle. And that's something that probably lies with legislators and with the guards rather than with Rutland, where we're more interested in, or I suppose we're,
but
more,
there are things we could do,
people.
Like, but we're not, I don't feel we're doing anything. So like, I think we could focus one campaign on the half-life of drugs, for instance. Lots and lots of people are being caught drug driving here, right, in Donegal. More people than drink driving now. Why not have a campaign specifically to try and discourage weekend cocaine use by saying that, and I'm not really quite sure what the half-life it is, but if you're stopped by the guards on a Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday, you could be put off the road. You know, that would be one thing. And I've just thought about that whilst we're sitting here. Do you know what I mean? But we don't really seem to be doing anything.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think interventions need to happen along a continuum. And in the first instance, first stage interventions should be programs and campaigns like you're speaking about that dissuade people from using at the very start. So don't get into cocaine to begin with. And then services and interventions need to scale up because, and without being a pessimist about it, we can have all those campaigns and hopefully, you know, you will see progress from them. But there will be a cohort who will progress along that trajectory and will end up using. And there needs to be services at that side of it as well, which is where we sit on the continuum in Rutland. But certainly there needs to be suites of services and interventions that exist along that continuum and scale up as the need needs it to.
And Emma, finally, I'm not sure if you would have a view or not, but I mean, are we at the point now in terms of its availability, its accessibility, people's attitude to cocaine, that, you know, the stick is not going to work, that maybe we need to look at, I'm not even saying legalization of it, I'm not sure there's a precedent for that, but I mean, the attitude and usage, the attitude towards and the usage of cocaine is such now, it's almost impossible, it feels impossible to put the genie back in the bottle.
Yeah, and I think, again, there needs to be different services to meet people in different ways. So I think our preference is people don't use cocaine.
Yeah, of course.
It's not safe to use. It's very, very dangerous. But there will be people who, regardless of that information, will carry on using. And that's why it's important that there are harm reduction services in place as well, too. It's not something that Rutland specifically specialises in, but we support anything that's going to reduce the harms associated. And you will see other organisations like at festivals doing drug testing and stuff like that for people, so that if they are going to make that choice, which we don't agree with, at least we're trying to reduce the harm associated with it. You have other kind of national things going on as well around decriminalisation, and that's a very kind of health-led approach and a less punitive. It's more carrot, less stick, as you're talking about there, Greg. And we would, broadly speaking, support that kind of health-led approach as well too.
Okay, listen, thanks very much for your time, Emma. I really do appreciate it. Enjoy the rest of your day. That's Emma Kavanagh, who's head of clinical services at the Rutland Centre. And the story yesterday in the papers, and we just wanted more info on it today, cocaine use is surging in women, with many using it as a low-fat alternative to alcohol. And that has been sort of backed up by some texts we're getting into the show. One caller said, I've seen many people taking it as a weight loss drug, and not being afraid of saying it. It's insane, says a listener. More here. Cocaine use often happens when people are drinking alcohol, as all inhibitions are out and they can't think of the harm that it does. But that's one cohort. I think there are some that are actually... that's part of the night out. That's what that's how they plan it, and they get the cocaine, and they maybe it's, I don't know what price it is, cheaper than alcohol. Maybe you get less slurry or whatever. I don't know what the complications or the implications are, but there's obviously plenty that people see attractive in it. Another caller says, people are very into their fitness these days. I know of a few athletes who take cocaine instead of drinking, as they're fresh for training the next day without the dreaded hangover. Wow, I am actually learning a bit about it today. I didn't realise it was that sort of common knowledge. Maybe it's time that drugs are legalised here in Ireland so that we know what people are ingesting. Another, the price of alcohol is through the roof, and there are very high placed people never agreed with me on this one, but I still maintain that we should have been doing more to advise about the dangers of drug usage as we were introducing minimum pricing, minimum unit pricing for drink, because if the price of drink goes up, then it's going to people are going to look at alternatives, and we weren't doing anything in that space. But as I say, there are people who know more than me in relation to that that wouldn't agree with me. There's a perceived decline in the stigma associated with cocaine use, says another listener, especially among younger generations, which can normalise its use in social settings. Cocaine is seen as the wealthy person's drug, and because the users are educated, they think they know what they are doing. Another caller says, I was recently at a house party and was surprised to see it being passed around, with the normality of it just being there, and even more surprised by how many took it. There's an interesting insight. Thank you. Greg, we too had a medical emergency at the weekend and totally agree with Susan. We had a very positive engagement with the system and the staff were amazing. We are still in an emergency care, but the staff have made a difficult time more bearable, and I hope... I hope you have a positive outcome in that situation as soon as is possible. And thanks for sharing that. We're thinking on you as well. I'm joined on the programme now by Derek Vile, who's chairperson of Killybegs History and Heritage Committee. Good morning, Derek.
Good morning, Greg. Are you well?
Yep. Thanks for joining us. Okay, we're talking about ongoing county council works in the Killybegs area. What's going on?
What is happening is a road, 2 kilometer road stretch from Killybegs, bypassing Fintra, has just started last week, and some heritage has come up in the take of the road. So some people were worried about that. They contacted me I checked it out on Friday and liaised with the council, and they're in the last day or two with BAM and the council to see if we can mitigate the problem, hopefully from an engineering rather than a heritage or archaeological solution. That would mean leaving the heritage in place.
Now, we're talking about a World War II lookout post at Fintra. Were we familiar? We knew this was there, did we? Or was it discovered as the works were ongoing?
No, we knew it was there. In fact, to be fair to the council, they did everything right. They contacted the History and Heritage. We also controlled Fintra School, so we were kind of mitigating any problems along Fintra School, which is a protected structure. And in that process, we highlighted unrecorded archaeology and filled structures such as this lookout post. So we were fully aware of it. There's three around Killybegs. It would appear, I'm only learning about this myself, Greg, but it would appear that there's 83 loops, lookout posts, they're known as loops, stationed around Ireland, but these three around Killybegs seem to be, if not unique, unique around a harbour, and they're completely indifferent architecturally than the rest of the lookout posts that are more familiar to people at St John's Point, Carrigan Head, Slieve League, right around the coast.
Now, what threat is there to at least one of these with the ongoing roadworks?
Well, it's in, currently, it looks like it's in the take of the road. But to be fair to the council, because I highlighted it on behalf of History and Heritage, Killybegs History and Heritage, which I'm the chair of, in 2019, it just seems to be, you know, a slight clerical error got lost in translation. Because the impacts on Fintra School, for example, and the drainage and the footpath and cycleway and everything that's going by there hasn't got lost. So it's just got lost in an email. It would appear that the road is not fixed, which is great news, because we thought this was the road was fixed, but it's in the road take. If you imagine coming from Fintra towards Killybegs on the left-hand side, so the ideal solution is an engineering solution. Move the road 15 metres out from the road take and leave it in place. People would be familiar with the tannery in Mount Charles. It was taken away, and it really didn't have to be taken away by Donegal County Council. It was a protected structure a few years ago when they'd done the Mount Charles work, about 2017 or so. And this would be very similar. So it's on the take of the road, on the margins of the road. Just leave the heritage where it is.
Yeah, and I'm sure this. I think the Mount Charles situation would have been responsible of TII, surely, rather than the council itself. But anyway, be that as it may.
Well, yes, you're right there. And what we're talking about in Fintra is a council job, a Part 8, they call it. Because I work on these projects as an archaeologist over the road, over the years, including for TII. But what's most important about any of this is these structures rest they're in the gift of the council to protect them, not to protect them, or to advise on the roads being moved. So that's the most important thing.
What do you see the future value to the region of retaining these lookout posts?
Great question. I suppose, in a way, this is a positive news story because it's making people talk about their World War II heritage, that 20th century heritage, and the role of the likes of Fort Dunree in Lough Swilly as a treaty port, along with two in Cork. And it would appear that Killybegs has these three lookout posts around it because it was critically important to the Donegal corridor and also the potential to ever use Killybegs in wartime as well. It was a naval base for the British up to 1922. And my guess are, when more research is done by historians and archaeologists, it'll point towards Killybegs' role in these wider things. But the Donegal Corridor, for people that don't know, is an air corridor 6 miles wide, going across Donegal Bay, touching into North Sligo, North Leitrim, and Donegal Bay, St John's Point, Killybegs area, Fintra. About 80 planes came down in that corridor during World War II, or as we call it, the emergency. These gun loops are built in 1939, and they go out of use after the war in 1945. So they're part of that world, the story of the World War. I suppose it's good we're in war in the Middle East and in Ukraine at the minute. Isn't it good to know that these events are never too far away from us? I think they should be left there for all of us to remember. Mm. War is not far away.
That corridor you talk of, a valuable part of our heritage. That corridor you talk of too, that was a flight corridor. Was it for bombers based in Enniskillen to hit U-boats off the West Coast?
Yeah, more, Greg. Yeah, excellent. More for spotting planes, but then they would have joined up with bombers from St Angelo, even in Enniskillen, or up in County Derry and other places. But the spotters, which is very interesting, the spotters in 1941, May 41, I think it was, for the Bismarck, came out across Donegal, the Donegal corridor from Lough Erne, Castle Archdale, spotted the Bismarck and with others, they targeted the Bismarck and took down Hitler's most famous naval ship, putting a dent in it. But just to back up what you just said there, these gun loops tie in with that Donegal corridor. That Donegal corridor also helped the Allies, the British and Americans, etc., Canadians in particular, that used the Donegal corridor to keep the supply channels open in the North Atlantic.
And that kept Europe fed. It points to the fact that we've kind of always flirted a little bit with our neutrality.
Well, I know you and I don't have time for this, and I mightn't be the right man to speak about it, but look, it's leading us into that whole debate that was never finalised. What did I come across last night, just to remind myself when I was talking to you? It was Irish neutrality, I suppose Irish problem with an Irish solution, which was we were neutral. I, as a tour guide, go around and I try and explain this to guests from Canada and America as best they can. So these gun loops, the details and the numbers over them are lookout posts. Some of them could have been used as gun loops, like the ones in Killybegs, which is a different story. But that information was only given to the Allies, not to the Germans. And so our neutrality, of course, was of convenience. And it was kept from the public, so we weren't informed. And officially, we've never been informed. But it's safe to say, a few years ago, I, along with other historians, started looking at a boat called the Robert Hasty. That was a trawler under disguised as a rescue boat for these downed airmen in the Donegal corridor. But it had other roles as well, including probably, and I can't say this definitively, but not only were the aerosines used to direct planes in, but also high-tech navigation and radar, early forms of radar. Okay. My own grandfather was in the RAF, and I have an interest in as well.
Fascinating, Derek. Listen, thanks so much for the chat. Really appreciate it. That's Derek Vile there, who is chair of the Killybegs History and Heritage Committee, talking about those developments there. Thanks for your texts, by the way, coming in to 086 60 25 000. Keep them coming, or give us a call on 074 91 25 000. A caller says the lights on the Castlefin Bridge are not working now for about a fortnight. The bridge takes a lot of traffic, right? We can have a look into that for you. But what we must do right now is take a break as we head towards the news at 10. We'll be back after.